All right, we're ready for our third case, number 19-13626, Robin and Lori Fisher versus the United States. Mr. Greenlee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Greenlee, and I represent Robin and Lori Fisher. Your Honors, this case presents a single issue for review, and that is whether Florida's recreational use statute bars business visitors such as the Fishers from bringing suit. We believe that ordinary principles of statutory interpretation compel the answer to be no. I'd like to start, if I could, with the structure of the statute.
Before you do that,
yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Fisher was injured in a completely public area?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how is he a business invitee or visitor at the place of injury?
Well,
I mean, you can be a business invitee mm-hmm. and then go to a place where you are not a business invitee anymore and everybody is allowed. So does the location of the injury matter for purposes of your argument or not?
Your Honor, no, we don't think that it does matter. I mean, the fact that we're here under the recreational use statute, it's always going to be the case that it's open to members of the public. But there are a couple points on this particular issue that I'd like to rely on. And the first is that at the Tables Beach, they occupied a different status because they could rent the pavilion. What matters is the entirety of the base. They had access to the entirety of the base. And so they could enter all sorts of different places. I recognize that our case would be far stronger if they were, say, at the beach house or one of these other places where the public wasn't invited, but that would be clear cut. Again, we think that based on the structure of the statute, that the legislature did not intend to displace the common law. And
can I ask you a quick question before sure. we get to structure? I guess I tend to think in statutory interpretation terms that, like, first let's focus on the four corners of the provision at issue.
Okay.
And then we'll sort of abstract out a little bit to see what else is going on in the structure of the statutory scheme more generally. But with respect to this statute itself, I mean, it seems to me to check all the boxes. You've got an owner, check, mm-hmm. who's provided the public with, access to an area, check, for outdoor recreational purposes, check. And then the statute says no duty of care, no duty of care, no duty of care. Right. Why is that just not dispositive?
Okay. Our argument on the text is as follows. And I'm going to read the provision at issue, and I'll quote it. A landowner who, quote, provides the public with an area for outdoor recreational purposes owes no duty of care to keep that area safe for entry and use by others or to give warning to persons entering on or going on to that area for any of any hazardous conditions, structures, activities. So the key words in the section from our perspective are the public and by others. And those are words that suggest that immunity applies to external entrants onto the land or strangers onto the land. So others stands in contradistinction to people who have a business on the land there in the first place. So that's our argument with the text. And I would also, the very next provision, section 375.251.
Can I just push sure. back briefly? I mean, I guess as I read that phrase, I would think that others stands in contradistinction to the owner. It's like the owner has no duty with respect to the world is the way that right. sounds to me.
Right. Well, again, we view that business visitors are an extension of the owner. For instance, and I'll just give, like, setting aside, you know, the statutory interpretation issue, and just purely on common sense, if your boss sends you onto the land and you get hurt, you could reasonably ask, why did he put me in harm's way? Why didn't he warn me that there was this latent defect in the land? But if a member of the general public enters the land without permission, has no relationship with John Doe property owner, then that person can't complain. He's on his own. He can't complain when he gets hurt. I'd also like to, there's another, the very next statutory provision, 375.251.2b. This is important. Notwithstanding the inclusion of the term, quote, public in this subsection and subsection one, an owner or lessee who makes available to any person an area primarily for the purposes of hunting, fishing, or wildlife viewing is entitled to the limitation of liability. And then it goes on, provided that the lessee provides a written notice of this provision to the person before or at the time of entry on the area, or posts it conspicuously on the area. Okay, so they recognize that it's primarily focused on members of the public, right? But if you open up your land, if you invite people, hey, you can go fishing, you can go hunting, you can view wildlife here, you actually, because it would upset their expectation, they might think, hey, I'm an invitee here. So you have to post that notice on the property, or actually give the notification to the person who enters the property. So that recognizes that term public, it has meaning, and it applies to people who are external. And again, I think that the strongest point in our favor is the fact that in the very next subsection, subsection 3, they say this applies across the board to all entrants who be they, you know, licensees, invitees, trespassers, it applies across the board. And in order to make sense of that provision, you have to conclude that it was an intentional policy choice. It wasn't an oversight that they omitted from the previous subsection, the one that's at issue in our case. They omitted that language, and the only way to make sense of its inclusion in the following subsection is to conclude that they didn't intend to displace the common law when they enacted it.
Go ahead, Judge Jordan.
No, that's okay. Go right ahead.
Just a quickie, I guess, on that score. I guess your argument is that by including the, you know, invitees, licensees, and trespassers language in sub 3, that sub 2 means to exclude someone, right? So it, as you said, it doesn't include everyone in the same way that sub 3 does. So it must exclude someone. So, but even if we grant you that premise, why is it that the excluded someone would be business invitees, sort of a subcategory of one of the three mentioned in sub 3? Why wouldn't we conclude instead, more realistically, it seems to me, that the excluded category would be either invitees as a whole, licensees as a whole, or trespassers as a whole? Why just your clients, basically? That's my question.
Well, we think that business invitees or business visitors is the closest analogy to what the status that they occupied. But also, to answer your question more directly, public invitees, you know, after reviewing the briefing, I sort of agree with the government. If you look at the definition of what a public invitee is, it's someone who comes in and is invited onto the property for the use, you know, a member of the general public who comes in and who's invited for that particular use that the property is held open to. So if the court were to say, you know, public invitees are they don't trigger the immunity under the statute, it really would kind of gut the statute. By contrast with business visitors, I mean, suppose the person is a janitor who comes on of no volition of his own without any, he has to come onto the land. We think that that person, and granted, you know, this would be an easier case from our perspective if they were there as a consequence, direct consequence of that they had to be in Tables Beach at that point. But having said that, we do think that when the landowner makes it available to you, then that person, you know, it comes with certain expectations, and the expectations are that your boss is not going to put you in harm's way.
Let me ask you a different question, Mr. Greenlee. You say that all of this has to be considered with the backdrop of the principle that a statute that is in derogation of the common law needs to be strictly construed, right?
Correct.
But you have a provision that the Florida legislature has left intact since the 1960s, mm-hmm. And it's section 375.061.
Okay.
And it says that the provisions of this act, which includes the statute we're dealing with, shall be liberally construed in a manner to accomplish the purpose of thereof. How does that statute play into your derogation of the common law argument, if at all?
Two quick points. My time is running low.
No, you can finish answering the question.
Okay. First, we think, again, you know, I'll return to my main point, that the there's nothing inconsistent with our reading of the statute and the purpose of the statute, because it still immunizes landowners from suit. Let's say that 100 people enter the property, 99% of those people, or 99 of those people, let's say 100 people get hurt on the property in a given year. If 99 of those people are members of the public, then the landowner would still be immunized from suit 99% of the time. And so only one person could bring the suit. So it's consistent with the purpose of the statute, in other words. So it's just not correct to say that the landowner would get no benefit from the statute. He would be immunized from suit. Any suit brought by a member of the public, he would gain immunity from that. But it's only people who under the common law would have an expectation that they would be treated with a higher duty of care. Only those people could bring suit. And to answer your question more directly, to the extent that the court considers that legislative purpose, I think it's really an equipoise with the other canon of statutory interpretation. One says you have to construe things that are, you know, so they're not in derogation of the common law. And then this other statute says, well, you should liberally construe things. So liberally construe and strictly construe, I view those as essentially being an equipoise. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve.
You've got all of your time left for rebuttal, Mr. Greenlee. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Grandy.
Todd Grandy, appearing on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. I want to address first the Fishers. There at the time Mr. Fisher sustained his accident, there was no fee or revenue generated associated with the public beach where he sustained his injury. So the record makes that absolutely clear. When I say the record, I mean the declaration of Jade Black, located at 11-1. But in any event, the bottom line is the Recreational Use Act is a broad grant of immunity to landowners who make their property available for public use. And it applies to all persons using these areas. The legislature makes it very clear in the Statement of Legislative Purpose in Section 1, where it says the purpose is to encourage landowners to make their land available to for public use by limiting their liability to persons using these areas.
Okay, I think I am generally sympathetic to your ultimate result, but there is an example that Mr. Greenlee mentioned that gives me pause. So a landowner who is covered by this provision, 375.251(2)(a), tells its employees to go to a completely public area and pick up trash. And those employees get injured. Putting aside workers' compensation, those employees don't have a remedy because of this statute against the landowner?
Well, Your Honor, the statute offers a broad grant of immunity to landowners who make the property available to the public for recreational use, and it allows for only one statutory exception, and that's the exception in Section 2C for property that is revenue generating, and that's not at issue in this case. So I think in your Honor's hypothetical, that issue probably would be addressed via workers' comp if the employee was taking care of trash at his owner's, at his the landowner's behalf.
I'll make the hypothetical a little bit harder for you. I'll try to squeeze you a bit.
Okay.
So it's not a statutory employee.
Okay.
It's a contractor. The landowner wants to pretty up a facility that it opens to the public, and it hires some sort of company to provide advice on how to beautify the premises.
Right.
And that entity has to send people on the premises to see what recommendations they're going to make. Mm-hmm. And when they go into, I don't know, let's say a public, you know, facility where, I don't know, movies are shown for free, mm-hmm. the floor gives in and those okay. people are injured. No coverage?
Well, Your Honor, the Florida legislature in enacting Section 2A expressly rejected the duty of care that would otherwise be due an invitee, whether that invitee is a member of the public and therefore is a public invitee, or whether that person is a business invitee. So I would say that because the Florida legislature has expressly rejected the duty of care that would otherwise apply to an invitee, what we're left with is a broad grant of immunity that applies unless the property at issue generates revenue.
There are no cases in the Florida courts on this provision, right?
Not that address this issue, no, Your Honor. Most of the cases, both federally and in the state, address the revenue exception in 2C, and that is the extent to which the property at issue either does or does not generate revenue, because if the property does generate revenue either by way of entry fees or otherwise, then the immunity provided by the statute does not apply. So most of the litigation seems to concern that. In fact, in two cases in this court, Clare versus United States and Fernandez versus United States, the litigation concerned the application of that provision 2C, but it bears mentioning that even in connection with that issue, this court and the Florida Supreme Court in Abdon focused heavily on the overarching purpose for the statute in Section 1.
Counsel, let me interrupt.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that hypothetical involving the contractor, the cause of action would arise out of the contract.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what it arises. It would have nothing whatsoever. I think for myself, have nothing whatsoever to do with this statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
It would be whether or not under the contract, the owner agreed to identify the contractor for injuries to employees in the course of the employment.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the contractor.
It would be a bargaining tip.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. That's exactly right. Thank you. But apart from that, we're left. Well, the cases construing the statute all focus intently on two things. One, the overarching purpose for the statute in Section 1, and the provision this court has already referenced, that's Florida Statutes 375.061, which provides that the provisions of the overarching act should be afforded a liberal construction to accomplish their end. And here, the overarching purpose is to encourage landowners to make their private property publicly available to the members of the public for recreational use. And the way the Florida legislature encourages that end is by affording the such landowners a broad grant of immunity from suit by anyone, really. I mean, and like I said, I think it's very telling. Go ahead.
Mr. Grandy, given the absence of case law from Florida, should we consider certifying the question to the Florida Supreme Court?
Well, Your Honor, this court certainly could do that, but I do think the grant of immunity is so broad and allows for only one statutory exception, which is not at issue in this case. So I think this court can resolve the case based on the a plain reading of Section 2A in conjunction with the language and the purpose language in Section 1 and the direction by the Florida legislature in Florida Statutes 375.061 to liberally construe the statute to affect its purpose. And here the purpose is to encourage private landowners to make property that otherwise a private property publicly available to the public. So I think taken together and considering all of those considerations, this court can easily resolve the application of the statute in this case, because in this case, I don't think there's any dispute but that the exception to liability provided by Section 2C for revenue generating property is not an issue. So what that leaves us with a broad grant of immunity designed to advance the statutory purpose included in Section 1. But of course, this court disagrees. we certainly get guidance from the Florida Supreme Court, but I given the clarity and the extent of the broad grant of immunity, I don't think it's necessary in this case. A couple other things I wanted to touch on briefly. The absence of the language, well, the language that the legislature saw fit to include in 3B, and that as far as I can tell, that language has been in the statute since its inception in 1963, that the inclusion of that language in no way undermines or diminishes the broad grant of immunity provided by Section 2A. That section, by its express terms, applies to persons entering or going on the area. In Section 1, the statute makes clear that the purpose of the statute is to limit liability to persons using these areas. So there's nothing about the plain language of Sections 1 or 2A that in any way evidences an intent to distinguish between different kinds of invitees. Because at the end of the day, whether you're a business invitee or a public invitee, the duty of care remains the same. And the Florida legislature in adopting 2A expressly displaced the common law by rejecting the duty of care that would otherwise apply to an invitee.
So let me ask you this. I think you're sort of collapsing the two points that I was putting to your adversary. So setting aside whether it might be, you know, sort of business invitees that are excluded, you know, by virtue of the difference in language, at a more general level, how do you explain the difference in language? I mean, like between sub 2 and sub 3, why would sub 3 include this sort of cover the waterfront, exhaustive, you know, serial list, and sub 2 not? If it didn't mean in sub 2 that somebody was excluded, you know, there's this general principle that where,
yes,
you know, sort of two statutes that are ordinarily understood together, one says something and the other doesn't say something. We attribute some meaning to that difference. What do you say to that?
Well, Your Honor, I tried to come up with an explanation for that. And looking at the amendments in 2012, 1987 and 2012, 1987 didn't change the language at all. 2012 did make a stylistic change to the language in 3B, but there is nothing in the various permutations of the statute over the years that provides any guidance or insight into why the legislature included that provision in Section 3B, but did not include it anywhere in Section 2. But that being the case, I would return to my point that nothing about the inclusion of that language, I frankly think that language borders on surplusage, because the grant of immunity provided by Sections 2A and for that matter 3A are comprehensive. And the fact that the Florida legislature saw fit to expressly displace the common law with respect to persons covered by the statute is very, very telling. So I really don't think the language in 3, I mean, I can't explain why it's in 3B and not in 2, but what I can say with a degree of certainty, I think, is that that language does not undermine the clarity of the language in 2A.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, let me see to make sure I covered all the points. Okay, Your Honors, for all those reasons, we respectfully submit that the district court correctly dismissed this the Fisher's case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12B1, and we would urge this court to affirm that entirely sound ruling.
All right, Mr. Grandy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Greenlee, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you very much. Judge Newsom, I'd like to return directly to that, the difference between subsection 3A and subsection 2. I think the explanation is, and the reason why it was included, is if a state deems the property so important and so significant that it's going to enter into a written agreement, and if you read the subsection, it says where such agreement recognizes that the state is responsible for personal injury, loss, or damage, then it drops down in subsection B, then this subsection applies to all persons going onto the area that is subject to the agreement. So the state is essentially, they're saying we pick up the tab and we will pay for the personal injury, then the landowner is completely immunized. And so that's not the case. I think it represents a policy choice on the part of the legislature to where the land is that significant. Like, let's say it's like a natural spring or an area of cultural or historic importance. And we're going to enter into an agreement with you to further incentivize you to make that land open to the public. And we're going to pick up the cost when somebody sues, then you have full immunity across the board. So that's what that provision is doing. And you see in subsection 2, they don't have that. The area is simply not as significant to the state. And that's why there's a lesser degree of immunity that's conferred under the statute. That's the only way really to make sense of why they included it in subsection 3, but not in subsection 2. And as Mr. Grandy points out, you know, they opened up the hood, they tinkered with the language. They know very well how to provide that across the board immunity to landowners, but they chose not to. They could have very easily revised the statute while they were, you know, while we're working on it, while we're tinkering with the language in subsection 3, let's just add additional protection to the landowners in subsection 2. But they chose not to. And you can't just assume, well, this was an oversight, or I don't know, you know, you can't just shrug your shoulders and say, I don't know why they did it. It has to mean something. And so what it means is that they did not intend to displace the common law with respect to subsection 2. That's the only thing that can mean. That's the only plausible explanation. I think we do have to make sense of why they would include it in subsection 3. Now, with regard to certifying the question, I think that's a very sensible idea. I mean, we're applying Florida law here, and this is an issue of first impression under this statute. Why shouldn't the Florida Supreme Court be the one to hold forth on what this, you know, they should be the ones to make sense of the statute, not the 11th Circuit. We're a federal court, and we think our position is that, you know, the modest way to go about things is to allow the Florida Supreme Court to tell us what this statute should, what it does mean. And in closing, I would just like to stress that the status of the entrant has always mattered. It's always mattered. It mattered in Post versus Lumney, Wood versus Camp, and even in the Abdin decision. The rationale of the Abdin decision, which is after the enactment of this, is that because you're a trespasser, you haven't gained anything that you wouldn't otherwise, you know, you stand in the same position that you would have been in. So the Florida Supreme Court looked to the status of the entrant when they made that decision. And that was the whole rationale behind the Abdin decision. So we think that the status of the entrant matters. And we think in this particular case, when your boss says you should make yourself at home, use all this property, they owe you a higher duty of care than they otherwise would to members of the general public, which this statute is designed to cover and immunize suits from. And so for all these reasons, if there are no further questions, Your Honors, we would ask the court to either A, reverse the decision below and allow the case to proceed on the merits, or B, certify the question to the Florida Supreme Court.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Greenlee. Thank you very much, Mr. Grandy.
Thank you, Your Honors.